With the emergence of the Oncotype DX assay, genomic profiling is now part of the standard non-protocol management of breast cancer, as demonstrated in our CME group's Patterns of Care studies, where the Oncotype DX assay is routinely utilized in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative tumors. I met with Dr. Matt Ellis, who's part of a team that's developing another genomic assay, which was the subject of several presentations at ASCO. I met with Dr. Ellis to discuss this work and other new developments in management of patients with ER-positive disease, and he began our conversation by reviewing the development of the new assay targeting intrinsic breast cancer subtypes.
Essentially, what we've done through the Strategic Partnering to Evaluate Cancer Signatures grant that we got from the NCI about 3 years ago, we developed an assay based on 50 genes that will generate the intrinsic subtypes, that is to say, luminal A, luminal B, HER2-enriched, and basal-like. There's a fifth class called normal-like. Normal-like is actually not a tumor type. It means that the sample is too tumor-sparse to give a subtype. And then what was done with these data was to produce a risk score. Now, the risk score works by taking an individual sample and assessing its properties with respect to gene expression patterns and its proximity to prototypic samples in the algorithm. So you ask the question, is this sample closest to luminal A or closest to luminal B, closest to basal-like, closest to HER2-enriched? And then that translates into a linear score, which can be applied to all types of breast cancer and incorporates standard clinical variables such as node status and tumor size. I believe that that assay will produce a gold standard for calling the intrinsic subtypes of breast cancer, which is rather important as we move forward and we start talking about subtype-specific trials. For example, we've been talking about targeting triple-negative breast cancer. But what is triple-negative breast cancer? How many are true basals? So this assay will provide an entry point, I believe, to those studies. The second thing is we took that data and we did something rather, I think, novel with it. We took that model into the neoadjuvant endocrine therapy setting. And so the big conundrum with hormone receptor-positive disease is there's a group of tumors that are hormone receptor-positive and biologically hormone-dependent. And then there's a group of breast cancers which are estrogen receptor positive and hormone independent. So in other words, the presence of the estrogen receptor in that tumor is not connected to the usual apparatus that would create estrogen dependence. And hitherto, there hasn't been a good way of sorting those two subtypes out. So in a paper that hopefully will be coming out fairly soon, we looked at what could be considered to be an in vivo estrogen dependence test, simply based on the labeling index of the tumor before and after starting an aromatase inhibitor or tamoxifen. And what we found, simply put, is that tumors that stop growing with endocrine therapy do remarkably better than tumors that continue to grow despite the endocrine therapy. And Mitch Dowsett and I created a relapse score or a relapse model which accurately predicts groups of tumors which have approximately 100% relapse-free survival at 5 to 7 years. Those tumors are characterized by the following things: low stage, but also low labeling index after starting the endocrine therapy. And interestingly, also, the maintenance of estrogen receptor, losing estrogen receptor, was found to be an independent bad prognostic factor. So having got that sort of simple model, we then asked the question, well, any predictive model, you know, multi-gene model that has proliferation markers in it and estrogen-dependent genes in it should work much better to predict the outcomes on endocrine therapy in samples taken after starting the hormone therapy, because those transcriptional signatures, like, for example, the ones you see in Oncotype, will be affected by therapy. And so the transcriptional signature for proliferation, if switched off, those patients would do better than if it wasn't switched off. Okay, so what we did was basically take our assay, which incorporates many of the same elements, proliferation signature, estrogen-dependent genes, to create luminal A and B type breast cancer. And essentially what we found is exactly what I'm saying. You can take tumors that have a high-risk profile at baseline because they have a proliferation signature. But if that proliferation signature is turned off, then the patients respond to neoadjuvant endocrine therapy and do well in the long term. If there's a proliferation signature at baseline and it is not switched off by endocrine therapy, they do very badly. In fact, those tumors are associated with ER loss at the end of the 4 months of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of ER testing in general and where you think RT-PCR might fit in? Oncotype's now reporting quantitative ER. Where do you think that's all heading?
I think that's the way it's going to be done. There's a tension, obviously, out there because ER testing is a distributed test. And, you know, a lot of people do it in the community and they believe they do it well. But if you look at the data, what you find is that, in fact, the quality is very variable. If you do a sophisticated subtyping test, and Joel Parker also showed this, in tumors that are clinically ER positive, at least 5% of them are basal tumors. And similarly, if you take tumors that are ER negative clinically and ask how many of those are luminal tumors by the subtyping test, 10% of them are luminal. So you've got a lot of missed subtyping based on ER, either because it's false negative or false positive.
You also had a presentation here on the neoadjuvant letrozole study group. Can you talk about that?
So that's many of the issues that I'm bringing up. So these are very important studies because the issue is, how do you predict outcomes on endocrine therapy? And what we've been doing all along is to take the baseline tumor and to try to predict it from that. And all I'm saying is we have to shift the paradigm and start the endocrine therapy for 2 to 4 weeks and then profile the tumor. And what we find is we get a much better prognostic index. Because the baseline sample will predict outcomes in the absence of therapy, in the absence of endocrine therapy, of course. But what you want to do is predict outcomes on the presence of endocrine therapy. And of course, that means that you have to sample the tumor in the presence of endocrine therapy. And so, of course, that's what enhances the prognostic properties. And that's what this study was basically beginning to show.
What's going on with the ACOS neoadjuvant endocrine trial?
The ACOS study.
Right.
Yeah, I'm the principal investigator, as you know, for that study. So this is a very interesting story because there was a lot of skepticism about this trial. We couldn't do a neoadjuvant endocrine therapy trial in the United States. Well, that's absolutely manifestly not true, as it turns out. We have, I think, approaching 230 patients on the trial now for a total sample size of 375.
Can you review the eligibility and design?
So this is a group of patients who are postmenopausal with estrogen receptor-rich tumors. So the Ulrich scores are 6, 7, and 8. So they're not marginally ER-positive. They're strongly ER-positive. So if people don't know what the Ulrich score is, the minimum entry requirement is to have 66% of the cells positive for ER. And then there's a randomization between the three approved aromatase inhibitors, exemestane, letrozole, and anastrozole, for 4 months before surgery. And then the tumor is sampled before the initiation of treatment, and we get both frozen and fixed tissue also at surgery. And then there's an optional one-month biopsy. So interestingly, after my presentation that showed the one-month biopsy could predict who would respond or not, we're now thinking about amending the trial, actually getting the one-month labeling index and giving it to the practitioner. So if the labeling index was not inhibited by the aromatase inhibitor, the patient's probably better off being triaged to chemotherapy. And right now, we think that's maybe about 15% of the patients. Of course, that dramatically increases the response rate in the patients whose labeling index was inhibited. And the patients whose labeling index was not, they're obviously much better on chemotherapy.
You know, my understanding about that trial was that the so-called winner of the three AIs was then going to be compared to chemotherapy. Is that still the case?
Well, that's where we were thinking. But since we can robustly identify non-responders to endocrine therapy at 1 month with that biopsy, then there's a group who definitely need chemotherapy and we don't need a randomization. The group who have dramatic declines in their labeling index, those patients are obviously doing very well with endocrine therapy and may not need chemotherapy. So there's actually, it's just like the Taylor X trial. There's a group in the middle where maybe the labeling index or indeed the change in the transcriptional profile is less than adequate. Then the question is, would it have been better to stay on endocrine or switch to chemo? And that may end up being the next trial to look at that intermediate risk group.
Any sense about which of the three AIs is going to play out more favorably?
Well, this is another subject of debate right now. Really, to answer that question definitively, Z1031 is underpowered. There's lots of reasons why it is underpowered, but partially because there was not a strong feeling at the government regulatory agencies that we'd be able to accrue well. Now we can accrue well. I think we're going to talk to them about increasing sample size so that we could get a more definitive answer.
Any speculations about what you might see?
I'd prefer not to do that. I think that there is reasons to think that one aromatase inhibitor may be more potent than another from a pharmacodynamic point of view. So letrozole suppresses estrogen more than anastrozole, for example, and multiple groups have shown that. But whether that translates into clinical benefit is the question, which will be essentially, this will be the only trial that will be able to answer that question. Incidentally, we do have serum on all these patients, so we will be able to look at the degree of estrogen suppression as part of the study. One of the issues that we're focusing on is what is the exact mechanism for endocrine therapy resistance? There was a couple of talks which are sort of rejuvenating the idea that maybe a drug such as gefitinib might have a role in reversing resistance. After a number of sort of questionable or negative trials, there was sort of a marginal positive trial presented by Christopher Nelli, I think, looking at the question of gefitinib. But I think that the mechanisms of endocrine therapy resistance are rather complex and diverse. And I think that we'll be having to sit down and probably looking at multiple different drug classes matched to the actual mechanism resistance that any particular tumor is exhibiting. An example where sort of a one-size-fits-all will not work well is, for example, the rapamycin trials that were conducted in combination with endocrine treatment are largely negative or only marginally positive. But that may be because rapamycins were a poor choice. Other drugs in the PI3 kinase pathway is what we're working on.
What were some of the papers presented here in breast cancer, in addition to your own work, that you thought were striking and maybe the kind of things that oncologists in practice would want to know about?
Well, I mean, everyone's talking about zoledronic acid as an adjuvant therapy. There was a provocative presentation from the Austrian trialist group looking at zoledronic acid in the setting of patients receiving premenopausal patients in the setting of an LHRH agonist, randomizing patients between tamoxifen and anastrozole. And interestingly, there was no difference between the two in that particular setting so far. But all the differences seemed to be driven by whether zoledronic acid was given or not. And it appeared that zoledronic acid did reduce bone metastasis, which was expected. But also there was a reduction in non-bone metastasis and even chest wall recurrence, which has obviously got everyone's thinking cap on. I think that Martine Picard got it right. This is a trial where they're presenting the data very early, I think, I don't know, almost inappropriately early, with only 10% of the patients in the entire trial experiencing an event at this point.
I mean, it was at 5 years.
It was at 5 years, but only, I mean, it says everything, doesn't it? But only 10% of the patients had an event. And these trials, well, you know, any of these trials probably require 10 to 15 years of follow-up. But nonetheless, I think this is very provocative. There are other observation versus bisphosphonate trials that we have to see. And if you remember, very early on, there was a study done in Scandinavia suggesting that clodronate might have an effect on visceral metastasis. So maybe we're seeing something of a sort of change in our thinking about what the role of bone is in promoting metastasis, even in non-bone sites.
Do you think this is enough to change your non-protocol management and offer bisphosphonates outside of protocol setting, or zoledronic acid specifically?
Well, it's, again, as pointed out by Martine Picard, it's a little tricky because not too many patients in the U.S. are treated with LHRH agonist plus an endocrine agent alone.
Without chemo.
Without chemo. But, I mean, patients are going to be asking about it. There's no question about it. Of course, it's an easy answer when they have a bone issue, isn't it?
Is taking an AI enough of a bone issue for a postmenopausal woman?
Possibly, but this trial was not done in that group.
I know.
This was done in pre's. So, I don't know, adding the bisphosphonate certainly isn't something that we should just do in everybody at this point. But everybody would agree with the statement, you have to monitor bone health, intervene with adequate vitamin D, which is another, or vitamin D. Everyone smiles when I say vitamin D. But so the vitamin D story is also something that's interesting. And many patients don't need a bisphosphonate if you actually manage them properly with vitamin D supplementation.
Can you talk a little more about that? And also there's a presentation here on vitamin D.
Yeah, so there's a presentation from Canada, from the Canadian Clinical Trials Group, where they looked at vitamin D levels and its effect on breast cancer outcome. It was a little bit complicated, but there was a definite message there that patients that were extremely D deficient did seem to have a worse relapse-free survival. And this is not inconsistent with other data suggesting that low vitamin D levels may be associated with higher breast cancer incidence. So I think we need to do more detailed studies. You know, there's a lot of issues coming out. I mean, you know, we've had the whole issue last year about diet and exercise and relapse-free survival. Now we're looking at adequate desupplementation and relapse-free survival as a potential way to improve outcomes. So there seems to be a lot of things that are actually in women's hands that they can actually do to improve their outcomes, being physically active, taking adequate vitamin D, perhaps, you know, maintaining a relatively low body mass index.
Do you think there's a role for looking at vitamin D levels in a routine clinical way or prescribing vitamin D routinely?
I have to say I measure the vitamin D level in every breast cancer patient I see.
And you use that as a way to decide whether to supplement?
Yeah, because if they're truly in the osteomalacia range, you have to give 50,000 units weekly for 3 to 6 months. The osteoporosis people will tell you that. And it's actually frightening how much severe D deficiency you do see in a breast cancer population. Particularly prevalent in African Americans, as you can imagine. But also, you know, I see professors' wives with D levels, you know, in the 10, 15 range, or even, frankly, osteomalacia range of less than 10.
And what's that from? I mean, sunlight exposure or lack of sunlight exposure?
Partially, because people are frightened of sunlight and don't want to get skin cancer. You know, a radiotherapist, a friend of mine, got frank osteomalacia because radiotherapists work in the basement all the time and under artificial light and don't get the appropriate wavelengths, ultraviolet wavelengths, to activate D. Many people maybe avoid D-containing foods. Maybe people are taking pharmaceuticals that activate D catabolism. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why people can be profoundly D deficient.
Did you happen to see the presentation by Joyce O'Shaughnessy looking at lapatinib and trastuzumab?
I did. So I sat next to Joyce actually just now when we were listening to the session on targeted therapies for breast cancer. So basically, if I got the figures right, this was a group of patients who had trastuzumab resistant metastatic breast cancer. And the randomization, I think in a modest size phase 3 trial, was to switch them on progression to lapatinib alone or reintroducing trastuzumab with lapatinib. So first of all, it seemed to be relatively safe to give lapatinib trastuzumab. And secondly, the number of patients who were progression-free of 6 months went from 13% with lapatinib to over 20%, I think something like 23 or 24% with trastuzumab lapatinib. So what that would suggest, in the resistance setting, you should continue the Herceptin and add lapatinib as a better strategy than stopping trastuzumab and replacing it with lapatinib.
Was it convincing enough for you to consider in a non-protocol setting?
There's beginning to be a case built for lapatinib-Herceptin couplet without chemotherapy, but I certainly wouldn't recommend that as standard of care at this point. There's not enough data, and we need to confirm it.
Is it something that you would do outside of a protocol setting right now?
Well, you always have desperate situations. I have a patient, for example, who has brain metastasis, and she progressed through lapatinib for her brain metastasis and was put onto Zoloda. This was not by me, actually. I just observed this response. Zoloda, lapatinib, and Herceptin appears to be doing better. And again, I'm not sure that's a very safe thing to do, but people are doing all sorts of stuff out there, you know, combining chemotherapies and various biologicals. So I wouldn't tell people, you know, people in this country seem to be able to do what they like. I think you have to be very careful about some safety signals with some of these combinations as well as potential benefit.
What's your experience been with lapatinib?
Well, I usually give it in two settings. Obviously, in the trastuzumab refractory setting, it's my next line of therapy to give capecitabine lapatinib, and it's modestly effective. I haven't seen it to be dramatically effective in many patients, but patients seem to get prolonged stable disease. For example, I got a patient with HER2-positive bone mets, no visceral disease, and she's been on that combination for about 18 months now and doing extraordinarily well. So there's individual patients I can think of done very well. And that's the truth for most of this stuff, isn't it? But also I've seen patients who appear to have got very little benefit from it.
What about side effects and toxicity?
Not too bad. I have to say I'm a believer in the week-on, week-off schedule with Zoloda. This is something that was piloted at Memorial Sloan Kettering by Huddis et al. And I do find it much better tolerated with much less hand-foot syndrome, not giving the two-week-on, one-week-off schedule, but giving the week-on, week-off schedule.
You mentioned the issue of brain mets. And how do you put together what you've seen in the literature and your own clinical experience in terms of lapatinib in the brain?
I'd say that, the literature shows this, and this is my clinical experience, it's only very modestly effective.
You were talking before about patients with ER-positive tumors that don't respond to hormonal therapy. What about patients with HER2-positive tumors that don't respond to anti-HER2 therapy? Where are we in trying to figure that out?
So there was a nice session with a discussion by Neil Rosen. There's a lot of enthusiasm for combining growth factor-targeted drugs with inhibitors of the PI3 kinase pathway. And there was some very preliminary results, for example, looking at the triple combination of Herceptin, taxane, and the rapamycin analog RAD001 or everolimus. And it would appear in the Herceptin refractory setting, that's actually an active combination, with the majority of patients actually experiencing either response or disease stability at 6 months. So I think that you may be able to at least modulate resistance to Herceptin by adding in drugs that affect signaling intermediates further down the pathway, such as rapamycin analogs, but also perhaps more direct PI3 kinase inhibitors or AKT inhibitors.
What do we know about rapamycin analogs in general in breast cancer?
Well, as single agents, they have very little activity as far as I can see. Perhaps the only one that showed anything more than very minimal activity is, again, everolimus. There was a phase 2 trial done by Garen Gelman where they looked at various schedules of everolimus and found some very modest single-agent activity. So I don't think they're going to be single agents. I think they are drugs that will be used in combination. They're reasonably well tolerated, but mucositis can be troublesome. There is mild neutropenia in some patients. The metabolic effects seem to be modest in terms of hyperglycemia or hyperlipidemia.
I'd like to get your thoughts about the long-term natural history of ER-positive breast cancer and long-term interventions and where you see that heading and what are some of the clinical research data sets that you think are helpful in trying to figure out how to deal with the problem.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I wrote an editorial for JNCI recently about this problem. It would appear from a variety of solid data sources that endocrine therapy is cytostatic but not cytocidal. So if, for example, you look at the neoadjuvant endocrine therapy setting and you measure apoptosis as well as proliferation and you measure it at whatever time point you like, what you find is that endocrine therapies, be it tamoxifen or anastrozole or any of the others, induce profound growth arrest, which is what we were talking about earlier, but they don't induce apoptosis. So what does that mean for the patient? What that means for the patient is that for many of them, the endocrine therapy is preventing the appearance of overt clinical metastasis, but it's not eradicating the metastatic clones. They're sort of in a holding pattern in a subclinical way, which of course would explain why any time you look at longer versus shorter duration of endocrine therapy, longer wins. Because, of course, the moment you stop the endocrine therapy, there's a population of patients with micrometastatic disease, which then begins to grow. This is probably even true for long-term tamoxifen. Whilst we've had both the preliminary results, you say preliminary, and these are incredibly long-term studies, but we've seen a presentation of ATLAS and ATOM now.
And can you maybe just talk about what was seen? Because the ATOM was just presented at ASCO. ATLAS was presented in San Antonio.
So a presentation of both ATLAS and ATOM take sort of full acknowledgement that the effects seen are muted by the inclusion of patients that had hormone receptor negative disease and also obviously problems with compliance with such long exposure to endocrine treatment. But both trials show evidence that longer duration of tamoxifen is better than short duration of tamoxifen, essentially beyond 5 years. So Sir Richard Peter was right in the sense that the clinical alert that came out that said 5 years is it, you don't need any more, there's no benefit for further treatment.
Maybe you see more relapses, what was suggested with the NSAVP study.
Yes. So this is a beautiful illustration why you shouldn't jump into Zometa, isn't it? Because you see one result and it's a bit strange, then everyone says give Zometa, and the next trial completely contradicts it, and then, you know, the buzz goes away. In fact, everything's wrong. So there's still a significant likelihood that I think that that Zometa result would be like the initial NSABP result, where it led to a complete change in clinical practice that led to, I'm sure, patients relapsing who wouldn't have done otherwise. So I think what my research is focused on is the question of how you convert cytostatic endocrine therapy into cytocidal endocrine therapy. So in other words, how do you induce apoptosis in estrogen-deprived breast cancer cells? And it would appear that you might be able to achieve this in a variety of ways, particularly, again, focusing on PI3 kinase inhibitors. So I think we will be in exploring a variety of agents, biological agents, which might improve upon the efficacy of endocrine treatment. And then, you know, if you actually eradicate the micrometastatic clones, then you don't need long-duration endocrine treatment.
What about at the current time? How do you approach clinically this decision when you see patients who, for example, have had 5 years of tamoxifen, or maybe patients who are completing their fifth year of an AI?
I use a shamelessly risk-adapted approach. So, you know, if a patient had 5 positive lymph nodes, I'm going to recommend 10 years of endocrine therapy at this point. Now, you're going to say, well, where's the evidence for giving 10 years of an AI? Well, there isn't any right now. There's evidence for giving 10 years of tamoxifen, perhaps. And certainly letrozole looked more effective after 5 years of tamoxifen than further treatment with tamoxifen does, even in the most optimistic scenario in ATOM and ATLAS. So these more potent endocrine therapies, more potent than tamoxifen, theoretically should have even more benefit with longer durations. So this is off protocol. It's what I do in higher risk patients. In lower risk patients, it probably doesn't matter too much, and maybe 5 years is enough. Obviously, that turns out to be a long conversation with the patient when she gets to 5 years.
Can you talk a little bit about the big study that's out there, and particularly what you think maybe we might see as this evolves in these sequential arms?
So there's going to be 2 updates, is my understanding. What we'll see at San Antonio, I'm assuming, this is what I've been told, is the outcome for these switching arms. The trial started off as a straight comparison between tamoxifen and letrozole. So there are a whole cohort of patients who, from the initiation of the trial, which were just the straight comparison. And then they introduced the 2 additional arms of either starting with letrozole and ending with tamoxifen, or starting with tamoxifen and ending with letrozole. So the data on those arms is obviously less mature than on the upfront monotherapy comparison. So my thought at this point is that you may end up in a situation where it's underpowered to be really definitive as to whether it's better to switch and in which direction. But I find it a little bit inconceivable that you would be able to catch up
starting with
the inferior drug and then switching to the superior drug, you know, because you'd have to imagine some kind of initial advantage in some TAM-treated patients when they're switched to letrozole.
Yeah, the thing that intrigues me is actually the letrozole followed by tamoxifen. Any thoughts about that and whether maybe you might see, you know, more of a benefit than you might expect? I guess I was wondering about, you know, maybe in my simple mind, you know, the resetting of the estrostat on an AI and then bringing in tamoxifen, maybe even the agonist effect having some benefit. Is that too fanciful?
Well, not really. And I can't, you know, so interview me at San Antonio, because we've been doing trials of low-dose estrogen therapy in metastatic breast cancer. And we're just completing a trial comparing 30 versus 6 milligrams of generic estradiol. In that study, if they benefited from the estrogen therapy, they were then switched back to the AI that they were on at the beginning when they had progressive disease. So you're asking the question whether you can switch from AI to estrogen therapy to AI to estrogen therapy to sort of get an oscillating tumor with prolonged clinical benefit. And without giving the game away, there appear that there's some patients that behave that way.
Just to clarify, did you say that at San Antonio they're presenting the switching data from BIG?
Yes.
Hmm.
And we're presenting our low versus high dose estradiol study.
Right. Actually, Chuck Vogel's on the same audio program that you're going to be on, and he told me to ask you about that because he's a big fan of estrogen and metastatic breast cancer. So can you talk a little bit about that and whatever you can say about what the research you've done on that?
So this was a multi-center study of 66 patients supported by the Avon NCI Partners in Progress program. And patients' therapy was randomized between 2 milligrams TID of estradiol, generic estradiol, versus the package insert dose of Estrace, which is 10 milligrams TID. So a pretty big dose. And essentially what we're finding is about a 30% clinical benefit rate with some quite dramatic responses. Not that high, maybe 10 to 15% actual responses. Interestingly, those responses can be predicted by a PET flare. So we actually took a PET at baseline and then after 24 hours and looked at the difference in the glucose uptake. And it's actually patients that have this dramatic estrogen-induced glucose uptake were the patients that then went on to respond. So there's a biomarker for response. But the 6 milligram dose is as effective and safer.
What about side effects, toxicity, and complications?
Well, we will carefully exclude patients who had uncontrolled hypercalcemia and a history of thrombotic events or myocardial infarction. And actually, in the whole trial, we saw no venous thrombotic events. And it's pretty well tolerated. I'd have to tell you, though, the flare reactions that you read about in textbooks are very, very real.
Clinically.
Clinically, when you give estradiol, with everything you've read about, but particularly pain in patients with bone metastasis, and also pain in patients with soft tissue metastasis.
And when does it typically occur? When
does it go? Very rapidly.
Like hours?
Yes.
Really? And how long does it usually last?
Probably up to about 2 weeks. Typically, when it's intense, you have to stop the drug and restart it. But it's a sign, as it says in the textbooks, it's going to be a responding patient.
What about GI toxicity, nausea and vomiting?
My impression is it's much lower on the lower dose, as you can imagine. And as it says in the textbooks, the older the patient, the less of the sort of breast tenderness and nausea the patient seems to experience. But it wasn't a big problem on either trial. I think, in part, when you're using generic estradiol, it's just a lot easier drug to give than the old-fashioned DES therapy, which is super potent estrogen and probably associated with much more side effects.
I interviewed one of Chuck's patients who was treated and responded, and she described an increase in libido, which Chuck says he's seen a few times. Have you seen that?
Maybe my patients don't share the intimate details of their life like they do with Chuck. He's a much more cuddly chap than I am. What I can tell you is I've seen really, really impressive clinical benefit. I saw one patient who I would be very happy for you to interview who had an ocular metastasis.
Wow.
She had diplopia and an ocular mass. Hmm. And soon after starting the estradiol, she got intense orbital pain. The drug was stopped. And then 9 months later, she's in complete remission with completely normal vision. So my other impression is it tends to work on older patients. Although, you know, I don't think the statistics necessarily bear this out that well, but my clinical suspicion is that, like again it says in the textbook, this is a therapy that works better in 70-year-olds than it does in 50-year-olds.
I think it also says in the textbook that the presumed mechanism of action is, quote, some kind of direct toxicity on the cell. I don't remember anything more beyond that. What do we know about what's actually going on in terms of the anti-tumor effect?
Right. Well, obviously, there's a lot of perversions of the signaling pathways in estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer, with signaling being affected by mutations in various pathways. So I don't know exactly how it works. Various mechanisms have been implicated, and of course, this was a topic of discussion by Craig Jordan in his acceptance of the Konosky Award. But it does appear, both in vitro and perhaps in patients, that you're inducing apoptosis. Which is an interesting thing because I told you earlier that estrogen deprivation did not induce apoptosis, but giving back estrogen to a long-term estrogen-deprived cell does induce apoptosis. It's a bit of a mystery, to tell the truth. I don't think we've really sorted it out.
Where do you think things are going to head with this?
Well, we'll see after I've presented the data. I think we'll probably see that estrogen reappears in our armamentarium for long-term endocrine therapy.
Anything beyond that? I mean, so you come in the adjuvant setting or, you know, being moved forward in terms of some other research platform?
Well, I think that, you know, as Craig Jordan would say, you know, maybe there's some real insights in some of the biology here. And if we could actually work that out, get some biomarkers of who responds, it might be that it would promote various interesting new ideas about adjuvant endocrine therapy. Paul Goss was presenting a trial of intermittent letrozole. So you don't have it on all the time. You switch the estrogen deprivation on, then you switch it off. I've just done that in a more extreme way by actually giving estrogen and creating a bigger effect than just stopping letrozole. Angela Brody is suggesting in her models that if the tumor is progressing on letrozole and then you stop, the tumor progresses some more, and then you reintroduce the letrozole and then it responds. In other words, this resistance phenomenon is actually rather temporary. And of course, if you could give intermittent endocrine therapy, then the toxicity would be less.
Speaking of toxicity of endocrine therapy, I'm curious about your thoughts in terms of the arthralgias that's seen with AIs. You know, the clinicians in practice are realizing, I think, more and more how much of a problem this can be.
Sure.
What do we know about the mechanisms that are going on and potentially how to avoid this?
Well, there's a couple of things that we're looking at. First of all, an intervention. Anecdotally, because we follow vitamin D very carefully in our patients receiving aromatase inhibitors, we found that patients who are experiencing myalgias tended to be those who had very low vitamin D levels, and then we supplemented them, and they seemed to get better. So we're within 6 patients of completing a double-blind randomized trial of taking patients who have what I'd call marginal D status. Obviously, it's not medically appropriate not to give vitamin D to patients with osteomalacia type D levels. But there's this group of patients whose D level is, say, between 15 and 30, where it would be reasonable short term to randomize them to vitamin D versus dummy vitamin D just for 3 months to see if their myalgias actually do improve by giving them high doses of D, which is 50,000 units weekly. So we've almost finished that study, which may or may not be positive. But I think it's a little naive to think that the vitamin D levels are the only explanation. And other people have looked into myalgias on AI, and vitamin D levels are not shown a convincing relationship. So the other possibility is that the activation of bone resorption by estrogen deprivation is inducing some kind of cytokine release, which is producing the symptoms. And right now, people are looking at cytokine panels in peripheral blood of patients receiving aromatase inhibitors to see whether there's a culprit. And I think that's actually quite promising research. You can tell from the way I'm enthusiastic about it, there may even be an identified candidate, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to actually give you that information right now because it needs to be confirmed. But it is really problematic. My approach is to make sure the patient has adequate D, and sometimes they have to be switched to tamoxifen. And when you do switch them to tamoxifen, usually they get better.
You refer to it as myalgias. A lot of other people call them arthralgias. What do you
myalgias, arthralgias?
I mean, where is it coming from? You know, where do you think?
Muscle and joints and bone. I mean, I think that it's a difficult to localize pain. It may have a bone origin. It may have a muscle origin. I don't think we're even clearer on that, are we? Some patients do describe, you know, centered in their hands and hand stiffness and sort of press their hands together rather characteristically. Other patients are describing, you know, large joint pain flitting from joint to joint. And other patients are describing sort of pains in their upper thighs and shoulder girdle. It's rather variable.
What about switching from one AI to the other?
Well, all I can tell you is that clinically, I've not found that a very successful maneuver. But of course, sometimes in these patients, we do more than one thing at the same time. You know, we may start giving them D replacement and change and AIs, and we're never quite sure what they're benefiting from. The last thing I wanted to mention is the Avado trial. I remember you and I had a session on the E2100 data in Miami. I got a bit hot under the collar because I said I was concerned about the trial and the fact that progression-free survival is a difficult endpoint.
And you're talking, of course, about the paclitaxel plus or minus Bev.
Yes, and I was concerned about the endpoint because progression-free survival is a difficult and rather unstable endpoint. And there seemed to be a disconnect between this amazing effect on progression-free survival and absolutely almost no effect on overall survival. And certainly with longer term, there wasn't. And what we see in the Avado trial is the differences between Avastin plus docetaxel versus docetaxel alone seem very narrow, nowhere near as impressive as E2100. So I guess that in part sort of underscores my point. Don't get me wrong, I do think that bevacizumab taxane is an active combination. But in terms of how much benefit you get versus the cost of it, obviously it remains to be quite a concern. If that becomes the standard of care, it's going to add $100,000 a year or whatever to the cost of care of patients with metastatic breast cancer.
If you sort of put the economic issue aside and focus on the risk-benefit aspects of the decision of whether to add bevacizumab to, for example, paclitaxel, how do you see that now?
Well, in my practice, I basically reserve bevacizumab for patients in visceral crisis. Because patients in visceral crisis, essentially, you have to give a combination that gives a high response rate. So if you combine, say, paclitaxel with another drug, And of course, take your pick. People have done all sorts of combinations, or you want to give navel bean Gemzar or something. You obviously, I believe, have more toxicity from those than giving them bevacizumab Taxol. And that is my preference, to give them bevacizumab Taxol, just because the E2100 data looks a bit better at this point. Although I would point out again that I think that the chemotherapy dose used in Avado was too high. The 100 milligrams per meter squared dose of Taxol every 3 weeks is very uncomfortable for patients. And I much prefer in the metastatic setting to use 75. And then the final thing, just as a word to your listeners, a very beneficial thing to do for patients on docetaxel is to cool their fingers and toes during the infusion. There's been a randomized trial of this, and it really cuts down on the nail dystrophy that patients get on docetaxel.
Exactly how long is it done and how is it done?
Well, it's a peak dose effect. So basically, during the infusion, they should cool their fingers and toes and maybe sort of, you know, for 30 minutes afterwards.
And how do they do that?
Just putting their fingers and toes in ice water.
Yeah, I can't remember who I was talking to about putting ice chips in the mouth to avoid mucositis. I think it was a transplant with myeloma.
Yes.
They
well, it makes
put
sense.
Ice chips in
they
their
give
mouth.
Them thiotepa or something in the infusion or something.
Yeah. That actually, I think it was a randomized study, as a matter of fact.
Well, yeah. Then, yeah. Well, I'm sure it would work with docetaxel. I have all my patients sucking ice.
Really?
Sucking ice and cooling their fingers and toes.
Just with docetaxel or other agents?
Well, anyone who gives these drugs knows that docetaxel is particularly problematic from the fingers and toes point of view. And in some patients, actually, they lose their fingernails.
Where are you using docetaxel right now?
Well, I use it in the adjuvant setting.
TC?
TC, yeah. I use a lot of TC.